This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Moonlight, which won the Oscar for Best Picture in 2017, was adapted from a script by my guest Terrell Alvin McCraney. He and the film's director, Barry Jenkins, won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. McCraney is now the creator of the series David Makes Man, where he's also an executive producer and writer. It's in its second season on OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Like Moonlight, it begins with a boy growing up in the projects in a Miami neighborhood who's neglected by his crack-addicted mother, which echoes McCraney's childhood. But in David Makes Man, the mother is able to get clean and stay sober. David is very smart and is one of two black students in the gifted and talented class at his magnet school. He manages to get into prep school, where he's again one of the few black students, and he's surrounded by students from families with money. The code-switching required going back and forth from the projects to school is confusing and complicated. In season two, we fast forward to David as an adult. He's become a successful businessman and is doing the marketing for a developer with political aspirations who's trying to revitalize the neighborhood where David grew up. But some people see David as just the black face for a development company trying to get zoning permission to tear down the projects, build a shopping mall, and gentrify the neighborhood with no concerns about displacing the people who live there. Meanwhile, David is still haunted by the shame and trauma of his childhood. Terrell Alvin McCraney is a graduate of what is now called the David Geffen School of Drama at Yale, where he now chairs the playwriting program. When he was a student at the Yale School of Drama, he became August Wilson's assistant. In 2013, McCraney won a MacArthur Fellowship, a.k.a. the Genius Award. Terrell Alvin McCraney, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show. The last time we spoke, Moonlight had just been released, and the film since won three Oscars, including yours for Best Adapted Screenplay. How has your life changed since then?
First of all, thanks for having me back, and it was lovely speaking to you then, and I've since become a fan, so thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
It's really interesting. After the Academy Awards, you know, a lot of opportunities sort of showed up at my doorstep, and I kind of, you know, didn't take a lot of them.
Why not?
To this moment, I don't fully know. I do know some of it had to do with just growing up waiting for the other shoe to drop, growing up anticipating, you know, the bear around the corner, as some specialists will say. You know, you grow up with a lot of trauma, you grow up with a lot of disappointment, and not feeling protected. You kind of think, oh, well, when this good thing happens, it's only in, you know, it's in service of this really bad thing that's about to come. And so I wasn't really spending a lot of time just feeling great about the accomplishment. My best friend will tell you, my best friend, Glenn Davis, who actually was just named artistic director at Steppenwolf recently, is, you know, was with me the night at the Academy Awards. And of course, you know, we've been best friends for 20 years, so I wanted him with me everywhere. And we get to the, you know, the governor's ball and the Vanity Fair party. And I'm like, I must have been there for 15 to 20 minutes before I just was like, I got to go home. And I left. I left the Vanity Fair party with all these, you know, amazing things happening and stories to tell. But I couldn't. There was just nothing. I wasn't feeling excited. I was feeling scared and nervous and out of place. And yeah.
This reminds me so much of David and David Makes Man, in the sense that, I mean, he's very different from you, but he, like you, seems haunted by the trauma of the past and is having like difficulty getting past that.
It's interesting that, you know, as a young person, when you grow up in neighborhoods like that, in Homestead or in Miami or in New York, everybody's like, oh, you got to get out of this life, you got to get out of where you grow up from. And that's so instilled in your mind that by the time you turn around, you don't even realize that all of your aspirations are to get away from the place that made you or helped guide you into the person you are. And if you're running on that autopilot, you turn around and you don't even know that you're part of, you know, decimating an entire culture and experience that was there. And so that, to me, it was so important to engage that, because that's That's exactly how I felt. I felt like, oh, you know, right after we made Moonlight, the projects that we shot it in, that Barry and I grew up in and around, are no longer there.
Oh, so they've been torn down to create a more gentrified neighborhood?
They are what they call a multi-use facility now. So they have, you know, mixed housing with some affordable housing, some market price, some, but all of that was one of the oldest projects in the country. It was built in 1926 and certainly the largest. And, you know, we filmed this movie here, and then all of a sudden, you know, it became really important for the county and everybody to redevelop that neighborhood. And it felt like, wait, whoa, did we, like, by shining a light on this, did we do something? And of course we didn't. At the same time, like, the intentional, you know, my next thought was, well, I need to make sure I preserve all the culture around here as much as possible, all the life that was here and is still here, as much as possible.
I was reading that there's something now called climate gentrification in Liberty City, where you grew up and where David Meek's Man was shot, and also where Moonlight was shot. That's in an elevated area, and with all the storms and the flooding in South Florida, an elevated area is like safer from climate change, and that's one of the reasons why Liberty City has been gentrified.
Well, realtors will deny it. They'll say, no, these areas just have good zoning laws or rights. And I was like, well, they've had those same zoning permits and strictures for years. You know, my grandparents have been there since 1954. So, you know, my father's lived there all his life. You know, I lived there for 20 years of my life. There certainly those zoning laws haven't changed. And the ways in which you can build a house there hasn't shifted. What has? And it absolutely is the what we call king tide flooding. You know, where there's a full moon and the sea comes up through the street in places like South Beach, and it's just there even without the rain. And then compound that with the rain and a full moon, right? That kind of flooding is almost impossible for those neighborhoods that are close to the ocean and to the bay to keep out to combat. And so, yeah, this slow, quote unquote, creep towards the elevated areas that are 6 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet above sea level. People have been talking about it for years, and people have been talking about it in Liberty City for years, but, you know, it's only now starting to make national headlines.
One of the similarities between you and your character, David, is, like we said, the trauma. You know, David's mother was crack addicted. She gets sober in the series and is really a kind of changed person. But for you, like, your mother never made it to that. And she died of complications from AIDS. And how old were you when she died?
22. There's actually two differences. I mean, you know, my mother had a crack addiction, but also suffered from severe depression and undiagnosed, and was rarely offered any access or resources to that. And I think David isn't addicted to a substance, but has a kind of addiction to this chaos because that's all he knows. And so when he's triggered, right, he goes into this kind of fugue state where he's just really, he uses all of his passion, all of his imagination to make these really big, dangerous decisions. And that was really important to me because I do that more than I've not been, you know, I don't think I have a substance abuse. I don't really drink, but I sometimes will throw myself into these really scary situations and powerfully chaotic situations in order to make my life feel like it's normal.
Wait, can I stop you there?
Sure.
Can you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, like all of a sudden I need to run a playwriting program and write, you know, a television show. And, you know, for example, I remember one time I was flying back and forth from Miami to New York to LA, you know, every 2 days in order to work. And that might sound great, right? People are like, oh, that's amazing. That's an amazing life to lead. But I was getting sick all the time. My anxiety was really high. I wasn't eating very well. I wasn't taking care of myself. I was just throwing myself at the work. And so in a capitalist society, we think, oh, that's normal. That's what you do. Until you realize that I'm not enjoying anything. People are like, well, what do you do for fun? I'm like, what do you mean? what are you talking about? Like, why are you skipping out on the Vanity Fair party with Halle Berry? And like, you know, there are people there that I've just loved in my entire life. And then you compound that with like, just, you know, not just, but American racism. So I've got to deal with the microaggressions and the sort of surveillance society we live in consistently, constantly, while I'm also combating my own frustrations about not being, you know, this flight's delayed. So now I'm frustrated and I can't act frustrated, because if I act frustrated, I'm probably going to get shot 5 times in the back, right? Or put on a no-fly list. So I got to be calm about that. And so I'm stuffing down all of who I am, not enjoying anything, not sustaining relationships, not contacting friends, not anything, in order to do these amazing things that make me feel like my life is normal.
Was it also about giving you a sense of like a positive identity? Like, I've achieved this. I'm not just my past. I'm not just like the trauma-stricken child. I have these achievements. I have these awards.
Yes and no. I mean, I think the part that's absolutely right that I will underline is it gives me a sense of worth, right? I am, because often I was told that I'm not worth much, right? I'm black, I'm queer, I'm in this world, my body has been attacked, my person has been attacked, all the things that come natural to me, the way I walk, the way I speak, have been told that they were worthless or less than. And that comes from, you know, societal femophobia, anti-blackness, you name it, right? And so because I was told that for so long, I have to do these things that are beautiful. I have to make these things that are amazing. I have to make these things that are compelling and touching and, you know, and the awards are great and good, but you know, you start to learn that those are never enough, right? People telling you that you're great and good, they're never enough. You still keep chasing. I got to make another thing. I got to make something more beautiful, more touching, more human. There was a time that I started with a therapist, and she was like, look, I can't technically make you do anything, but if you keep doing this, I do have the ability to write to your employers and say like, hey, I don't think this person should be working right now, and I just think you should know that. And I was like, oh yeah, that's if she's willing to go that far, I need to take stock, because I'm clearly not looking at how ragged I'm running myself.
Did you just stop, or did you just like cut back a little bit?
I just stopped a couple times. I just stopped. I kind of just like,
did that mean telling people like, sorry, I'm not going to meet the deadline. Sorry, you're not going to have the play that I promised I was going to write.
Yeah, lots of that. Or I would just finish everything and go, nope, don't ask me for anything else.
Yeah.
Or I can't do this anymore. Or setting deadlines of like, yo, I'm not, that's, you know, this is it. I'm not interested in anything further than this, or, you know, my engagement is thus. And, you know, I was running a community program here in Miami, and trying to do that and run the program at Yale and do an outreach program in LA. And, you know, it got to a point where I said, you know, I really want to take stock in the, you know, the intimate, and how to make that epic. And there's a part of me that knows that this is that, you know, I was given a strength, right? However I arrived here, I do have an ability to do a thing and do it well for myself, right? And I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to create and make work.
David, in your series, and the main character, Chiron, in Moonlight, they were exposed to violence growing up in the projects. And it sounds like violence is something you were exposed to too. There was a person in your life, kind of like in Moonlight, who was both a drug dealer and your mother's boyfriend and a kind of father figure to you, who was shot and killed. This might be too personal to ask, but in addition to witnessing violence, were you the victim of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's not personal. It's in everything. I mean, in Moonlight, it's so funny because I remember Barry called me a couple times or wrote to me or maybe texted me a couple times asking me about certain scenes, you know, certain moments and going, wait, did this really happen? Or do you remember writing this? And most of the time I would say, no, I don't remember writing it. I remember feeling it. I remember going through it. I remember when it happened. And oftentimes folks, you know, talk about the film or even the television show and will think about the fantastic parts and go, or the parts that they feel are the most naturalistic and think, oh, well, this really happened and that didn't. And I have to correct them sometimes, like the thing that they don't, that feels so amazing that couldn't possibly have happened, that actually happened. So
like
for
what?
Example,
yeah.
Well, because everyone's like, well, did Kevin really befriend you one day and then walk into the spill out area and, you know, play a game called Knock Down, Stay Down, where he punched you over and over again and asked you to stay down. I was like, yeah, absolutely, that happened.
This was in Moonlight.
Yeah, that absolutely happened. That's true. Like, kid, as far as I know, kids still play that game, right? And yeah, he even apologized and even said to stay. He's like, look, just stay down. If I hit you, just stay down and then they'll stop. Right. And to me that, you know, that was really, it was a betrayal. Cause I was like, well, why must I like allow myself to be humiliated and harmed in this way in order for, you know, you all to have a great time or feel better about yourself? Like what about that is necessary for me?
It must have been a very confusing world to grow up in, code switching between living in the projects and going to a magnet school and going to a prep school. And like in David Makes Man, what you need to do to get respect in the projects is if somebody pushes you, you'd better either push back or punch him, because otherwise you're going to lose respect. But in school, if somebody pushes you and you push back or punch him, you're going to get suspended. That's like not acceptable behavior. And that did you go through that kind of confusion growing up, like having to completely change the rules depending on where you were in order to succeed or to just like get enough respect so that you can survive?
I don't know if it was confusing as much as it was exhausting. I say that, and I really mean that. I mean, it's still exhausting. The social kind of interactions of all, I mean, everybody code switches in some ways. And I think, and even going to, you know, even going from living in Homestead, which is, you know, outside of Miami, and living in Liberty City and then going to school in the suburbs and then going to magnet school or going to school in the inner city, like every single place had its own, you know, code of conduct or its rules, right, for respect and respectability. Even now there's a respectability politic that, you know, sometimes, you know, when people are like, well, when you deal with the cops, you should deal with them in this way, or don't stand up for your rights, or you should stand up for your rights, or say, like, it's so exhausting, the amount of like, you should do X in order to, you know, survive. But it becomes such a part of you. It becomes such a habit, this switching to survive, that you don't remember to turn it off, and you start doing it everywhere. You start doing it at the doctor's office. You start doing it with your intimate partners. And at some point you forget to just be, you forget to allow your most, intimate self to come forward because you're trying to figure out how to survive a moment that isn't about life or death.
You know, we've been talking about like childhood trauma and kind of carrying that and the chaos of childhood into adult life and what you've been doing to try to work your way out of that. Your character in David Makes Man really lives in his head, and he actually sees people who aren't there. He sees his dead father figure, who sometimes gives him good advice and sometimes bad advice, but he literally sees him and talks with him. And it's disturbing to him that this happens because he knows he's dead and yet he's appearing to him. And it happens with, he sees his younger brother when his younger brother isn't there. And I'm wondering, I imagine you've lived very much in your head for most of your life. And I'm wondering if your imagination ever went that far as literally seeing people as if they were there.
I don't know. I don't think so. I do. What I do is something very similar, though. I imagine people passing away because when I was growing up, I was used to, you know, coming home. I came home and, you know, Blue had passed away, and I had lost a great aunt. And even this path through COVID, I lost my mother's sister and my grandfather's sister within a week's time of each other. And so death was so prevalent in my life that I just built this really strange habit of going, oh, I got a call that this person really close to me is now not with us anymore. And I would just imagine what that scenario was like. And I would go through the whole entire process of feeling it, knowing it, trying to take it in, trying to figure out what I would do next and imagining it.
What was the purpose, like a test for yourself? Like, can I survive this? Like, say this person I love dies. Can I survive this? What would I need to do to survive?
It's stay ready. Stay ready. Chaos is all around us. This is what happens. Stay ready. And it was a test to figure out like how much I knew I loved you or I cared about you if you'd gone through that process in my mind.
You know, you mentioned earlier that your mother suffered from undiagnosed depression. How old were you when you realized that? And did it help you understand and forgive her, knowing that she had an untreated mental health issue?
I had to be 13, and the therapist at the magnet school that I was at Mays Middle in Goulds, said, you know, I think you might be depressed. And I said, maybe. And then they started telling me, I will never forget, Dr. Sands, Mrs. Sands said, I think you might be depressed. Here's some things that you're doing that, you know, that happens when we're depressed or sad. What's going on at home? And I thought, oh no, my mom is just like that. I can't be depressed. My mom is exactly like this. Withdrawn sometimes really forward, sometimes really outwardly affectionate, and then sometimes just, you know, inconsolable, moody, sad, distant. And so I realized, I was like, well, we both have it, whatever it is. And it just became easier. I remember, and it also happened that year she was 31 and I was 13, and I just thought that was really cool. So I just felt like it just made it easier for me to always identify like, oh no, we are connected in this way. And forgive her. It wasn't even a matter of forgive her. I understood her. And at that point, it just became easier to just be there and be a part of it. Now, there were things that were still hurtful, of course. But you know, it just made it simpler for me there was no gulf between where I couldn't recognize who she was.
Did you talk with her about that and say, look, I think you're suffering from depression. You should get help for that. What was her reaction?
There were two things. One, she was very receptive to saying, you know, sometimes I don't feel great. But then the other part was, well, I'm not an addict, so this doesn't matter. Right. And so she was in that part of denial that she couldn't quite, you know, come to terms with at that moment. I mean, later she did go into rehab a few times. But at that moment, she just, you know, there was a 13-year-old diagnosing her with depression and telling her that she was a drug addict.
Did you have to keep things like that a secret, if not in the projects, when you were in school?
Well, I didn't. And there are parts of me that wished that I had. Because we almost ended up in the foster system because of it. And we were, you know, when people started realizing that, because people would say, well, why don't you ever have like clean clothes? You wear like the same thing every day. And I would go, well, we can't go to the washing machine. We can't use the washing machine. We don't have any money. The lights are off, or we don't, you know, can I call your mother? The phone's off, you know. Well, what did you eat today? Well, we don't have a lot of food, so I ate when I got to school today. And so I wish more so that I had some ability to, and again, this is wishful thinking in hindsight, so it doesn't, it's like magic thinking. I wish I had some ability to take better care of us at the time, but I didn't. Because once, you know, once the school did find out, once the projects did find out, we, you know, they took us away from our mother. And some of that was great because, again, she had to go to, she went to rehab and had to focus on herself. But when we were taken away, we almost, there were four of us and we almost ended up in the foster care, system. And, you know, that could have been worse. I thank God that we had some family members step up and take care of us at that time.
Did you move in with them or did they move in with you?
No, we moved in with them. So my sister, my younger brother and sister moved in with my aunt and my brother and I moved in with my dad and my grandparents.
Did you become close with your father?
I wouldn't say close. I would say, I mean, we are closer now, but at that time, not really. Because again, you had this kid who was, again, 13, 14, used to surviving on their own, now being asked to follow new rules. And I did what I do all the time, which is I just go, oh, what do I have to do to maintain peace in this place? Great, I'll do that. And then I'll still do what I want to do when I go to school. For instance, I signed myself up for the magnet school that I went, the performance art school that I went to, unbeknownst to him.
Was there any less code switching that you had to do in the performing arts school because you were dealing with people aspiring to be artists? And a lot of artists feel like they're different from other people. And I don't mean that like I'm better than, but just like they're on their own wavelength and they understand other people who are on their own wavelength. And a lot of artists suffer from depression and understand what that is intuitively, even if they don't have the language.
Oh, well, it took me, I mean, no, there was still code switching. I mean, I was in school with, you know, the student, you know, with students who lived on Star Island. So that there was still.
Is that a wealthy community?
Yes, sorry. Star Island is where Puff Daddy lives.
Oh, okay.
And Will Smith.
Say
and,
no more.
Yeah. And so it was not Liberty City. And so I was being bused into, you know, I was taking the train from Liberty City to the school that was small and intimate, but also filled with students who had been practicing their art all their lives, but with tutors and had drivers show up at school to take them home. And I still, you know, would have to take a jitney or a bus home.
Did you have the kind of pressure that your character does of thinking like only one black person is going to be allowed to succeed here and it's got to be me?
Yes. Not at my art school, but in undergrad for sure. And even in grad school, the more the elite, the institution, the more that's true. There only graduated two black men in my acting class in undergrad. And we started as a class of 50. We graduated a class of 20. And there were two black men. I was one of them. And in the playwriting program at Yale, now known as the David Geffen School of Drama, I was the only black person out of 9 playwrights.
That certainly increases the pressure, right?
Well, it just increases increases a whole bunch of things. It increases the ability to feel like you're in it for the actual art, right? Or rather, are you there to represent who you are as a person? I mean, there's a reason why I was August Wilson's assistant, because there was no other black playwright in the program at the time.
Oh, we'll talk a little bit about being August Wilson's assistant. At what point in his career had he written Fences, The Piano Lesson, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom? Where was he?
Oh yeah, he was working on his last play in the cycle of plays, Radio Golf. And that was to premiere at Yale, which a number of his other plays had done previous before they went on to success on Broadway or in other places. And I was his assistant, and I was a terrible assistant.
What were you expected to do, and why do you say you were terrible?
Well, I'm bad at keeping my own schedule, let alone, you know, keeping August Wilson's. And so I was sent to sort of help him maintain and manage his schedule with both Yale and the production. And I just was, you know, terrible at it. I was very bad at it. Narda Alcorn, who was the stage manager, you know, would help me out tremendously. But Mr. Wilson would need a haircut. And I go, okay, great. And it was like,
not
no, yeah,
about it.
yeah, you have to go find, you know, and then I would go, oh yeah, okay, cool, great, got it. And I would just go do it. And then once he sent me off to buy, and I think I don't know if I've ever told you this, but He sent me off. He would send me on these very strange errands. So the last one he sent me on was to go and buy an iPod for his daughter's birthday. And he gave me a envelope full of $500 worth of 20s and sent me to buy an iPod. And this is like, you know, 2004 or five. And so it's, you know, iPods aren't everywhere and there's no Apple store. So I had to go all the way to Orange to get it. I get it. I come back. I go, here's your iPod. I got to go to class. I go to class. He calls me again and he's like, hey, I need to talk to you about this iPod. It's not working. And so I go to, and he's sitting outside smoking a cigarette and it's like, you know, 40 degrees outside. And I go, sir, I don't know much about iPods. I don't even have one. And he goes, well, I saw your play and, you know, you did some amazing things in it. You blew up things at the end, but that's just a young playwright thing. But you have music in it and you always need music. So here's your iPod. And he made me go buy my own iPod and gave it to me. And I kept that iPod for a long time until I went to Sundance and it's finally died. And I buried it there under a rock that has his name on it. But he, you know, he was just really generous with his time and his space, especially for early career artists and for his collaborators.
That's a lovely story. What did you put on the iPod?
I put these spirituals, these Gullah Island spirituals on it, and I would listen to them all the time. And that actually inspired Choir Boy.
Good. I want to talk about Choir Boy. And why don't you give us a brief description of the play?
Choir Boy centers around a young man named Ferris, who's the lead of Charles R. Drew Prep's prestigious glee club, which has won national acclaim for this high school. And Ferris, who is an effeminate young man, is trying to make sure that his voice and his way of making music is seen as not only prominent, but the way in which it needs to be done for the legacy of the school. And he's met with some challenges to his person through his classmates and the institution. And even though he clearly is one of the brightest stars in the school, his light may get diminished because he's trying to do it his own way.
Your grandfather was the minister of a Baptist church. Did you spend a lot of time in his church when you were growing up? Did you sing in a choir?
I did sing in the choir. I didn't sing in the choir at his church, but I did sing in the choir. I can't sing. I don't know why anybody would let me in their choir. But I did spend a lot of time in the choir, and I spent a lot of time in my grandfather's study. So when he would do, you know, study for his sermons and do research and read the Bible and scan, I would spend a lot of time with him there.
Did you read the Bible too? Did you find beauty in the Bible?
Yes, still do.
Do spirituals speak to you? I don't know if you're religious, and if so, how much a part of your life that is. But I think spirituals and hymns, gospel music, that they have a universal message, whether or not you are a believer in a God. There's songs about endurance. There's songs about resilience. There's songs about living in a world with something larger than yourself.
Mm. That's what all great art should do, is remind us that there's something larger than ourselves and that there's resilience and that there are different ways in which we engage it, but that we are more alike in our engagement than different.
Oh, and let me just add, there's songs about death. I mean, so many hymns and spirituals are really about death.
And change,
yeah. And these are all themes that we've been talking about, you know, in the interview. So I want to play an excerpt of Motherless Child as sung in your play, Choir Boy. And the version we're going to use, because it's not like there's a cast recording, the version we're going to use comes from the New York Times, which had the wisdom to do a video of this.
Yeah.
And so you can see the whole performance of the song on the New York Times website at nytimes.com. So here's Motherless Child as performed in Terrell Alvin McCraney's play, Choir Boy.
Sometimes I feel, sometimes I feel like Like a mother.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Sometimes
I feel. Sometimes I feel
like a mother.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Sometimes
I feel. Sometimes I feel
like a
mother. Like a motherless child.
A long,
long way
from.
Sometimes I feel like a
like a motherless child.
But I can hear my mother calling me. She's calling
me. I can
me.
Hear her call me.
I can hear my mother's
I
voice.
Can hear her call
I can hear my mother's
I
voice.
Can hear her
she's
call,
calling me.
I'm alone away from home. I can hear her call me.
Won't you come on home?
I can child. Hear her call me.
Cross the water.
I can hear her call,
but I'm a long way from home.
True believer.
True believer.
True believer.
True believer.
True believer.
True believer.
Yes, I'm a long way from home.
True believer.
Yeah.
True believer.
Home. That was Motherless Child as performed in my guest Terrell Alvin McCraney's play Choir Boy. And again, if you want to see the whole song, go to the New York Times website.
What I love is that you brought up that we don't have a cast recording because so many people are upset that we don't have a cast recording.
It's frustrating. I'd love to have more that I could listen to at home.
Yeah.
Some of it was performed on the Tonys, and that was great.
That was. And I think it would be great if they did a cast recording.
You also wrote a play called Wig Out, which is set in...
It's set in drag houses, yeah.
And I read that you dated someone. Dated sounds like such an old-fashioned word, like you're going to the malt shop together and having an ice cream soda. But
well, some of it was that.
Okay. but that you dated somebody who lived in a drag house. And I wonder if that required like another form of code switching for you.
Listen, at this point, we should just assume everything does. You know what I mean? For me, and that's one of the things like I have to work on is that I'm always doing it. And even in that moment, I absolutely had to because there were so many rules, coming into a chosen family and dating someone in that chosen family. There was a fiercer protection. There were so many things that they would say right in front of me like, oh, are you all sorry, I know you're not supposed to say that online, but that's what they would ask me. And I'd be like, I don't know, not yet, no. And they would be like, well, you need to do this and you need to do that. And that's my sister. And if she, and I'd be like, okay. But ultimately, it was really important to me to write about the way in which, you know, I thought I understood and knew everything there was about, you know, queer life and didn't. And was introduced to this world via a person who was unbeknownst to me in the beginning of their transition. And that was just an incredible moment for me. And I just wanted to honor them. But yeah, we don't do that play that often because the world has changed so much since then. And like, you know, I would have to up.
And the language has changed.
Absolutely.
So much,
we've made great strides and we need to do more. We need to protect Black trans women particularly, but trans women in general way more than we do. And I think I love the fact that like it sounds crazy, but I love the fact that play is outdated.
Oh no, I understand what you mean because things have progressed. Things are
we have language now. Like now there are young people who are my age at the time who are dating, you know, people who are trans and non-binary with the language to discuss it and understand it at the time and at that. The time I didn't know and didn't have the language to discuss it. And so I love that. I love the fact that there may be less need to code switch, right? Because there's more transparency.
When you were growing up, getting back to your childhood, did you have somebody, like a younger brother, who you had to protect, who you felt the responsibility for protecting?
Yeah, for sure. I have two younger brothers and a younger sister. I'm the oldest of four. And not just them. I mean, so for example, I remember when I did get friends, I would not want to walk with my friends because I knew that if people, you know, were going to target me for being queer or for being gay, I didn't want my friends to have to endure that too. So I would, like, you know, just say, oh, meet me at this place, so that if I had to endure it, I'd have to endure it by myself. And even as I got grown, I remember walking with Andre Holland, who played Kevin in Moonlight. We were in Harlem one time, and we were walking through a part of, you know, just the Block Boys. You know, Harlem's beautiful, but this one block was like the Block Boys were on it. And this was really early on in our relationship. We had to both be in our late 20s. And we were walking by, and I was like, oh man, I don't want Dre to get heckled because I'm about to be, right? Like, I don't want him to have that. So I made some excuse of like, oh, I'll catch up with you. I'll walk this way. And I walked, you know, I walked through, and, you know, some people, you know, a couple of dudes said something, but nothing really egregious. But I just realized I'd gone through all of that to protect him, to make sure that his feelings weren't hurt, or for him to be looped in with me. And I did that with my brothers and sisters all the time. I always was trying to stop them from getting the brunt of whatever it was.
Well, this has just been so good to talk with you. I really appreciate it so much. And I wish you good health. And I wish you all good things.
Oh, same to you and yours. Thank you so much again. I appreciate the invitation.
Terrell Alvin McCraney won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film Moonlight. He's the creator of the TV series David Makes Man, which is now in its second season on OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, spyware. We'll talk about how a private Israeli spyware company leased military-grade spyware to governments that were supposed to use it for tracking terrorists and criminals, but it was used to hack the phones of journalists, human rights activists, business executives, and others. My guest will be Washington Post reporter Craig Timberg. I hope you'll join us.